The quotation I found before is, "The dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay." Now life, in Santa Mesa outside of Manila, about 8 miles, was quite different from that at Calapan. 10 or 12 of us lived in a house, Nipa's house across from the commanding officers' quarters. And we'd frequently go to town, go to the theater. Army Navy Club was our port in the city. And it was very pleasant there to eat your dinner out in the open, in the courtyard which the building surrounded. It is on an old street called Calle Cabildo. The whole regiment was there, so there were plenty of officers, plenty of amusement which would come from the contact with them. Had horses to ride, not very good ones, but still horses. And we would ride into the city and go to the Luneta for the band concert. Luneta is now far inland, comparatively speaking. And the thing has lost its attraction entirely, because everybody practically in Manila, in the our social order, would go to the concert in the evening and circle the Luneta, call on each other from carriage to carriage, and listen to the music. That, of course, has all disappeared. But it is one of the most attractive phases of life in Manila, as contrast to the quarters in these two places I've just mentioned. I was stationed up at a small town on the Laguna de Bay, and there I lived in the extension of the church, which was the convent, and my room was off the gallery of the church, and there I ate my meals and had my bed and did most of my living, except in the evening it is the custom to take a large quart tin cup of coffee up in the tower of the church and drink the coffee and eat the cracker, looking all over the bay. You've got a magnificent view. And I flew over that very low when I landed in the Philippines on my way to China in 1945. Then there was another station which was good shack, but a terrible life. That was on an island in the Laguna de Bay, the prison island. And the prisoners were the dregs of the army of the Philippine insurrection. They were the toughest crowd of men I have ever seen. And you had to count them twice each night. And to go through the barrack there, where they were lying stark naked on these gold metal cots without any sheets. We didn't use sheets, any of us, at that time. It was a very depressing sight. The kitchen, I saw a man attacked there with a cleaver. I don't remember whether he was killed or very badly injured, but I remember I was officer of the guard, or officer of the day, and I was in the kitchen about 3 in the morning when this attack occurred. We were not there very long because we were relieved by the 7th Infantry from the States. And their depression when they saw the place was very great. Our elation when we left was even greater. I remember we had two dogs that the company was very fond of. And they had been puppies when they had started to raise them at Santa Mesa outside of Manila. And when we came down the river this moonlight night being towed by a launch, I was riding in the launch, and the men were in one or two large cascos, as they call them. We finally came to the bend, which was not far below Santa Mesa. And the men all bade farewell to the two dogs, and they were thrown off the boat at that point. And there was almost weeping on the part of the men at their having to get rid of them because you couldn't take them to the States. I don't recall any interesting points of my service at these other places. There were the usual things that happened to every young officer. And it was a pretty rough, tough, hard-drinking crowd. I didn't drink at all in those days. I don't think I ever took a drink in the Army. I'd been in the service about 3 or 4 years. I never cared much for liquor anyway, and I used to say, and it was rather accurate, that I only drank to laugh at a poor joke. But I started to taking a cocktail or whatever it was after I'd been in the service about 3 or 4 years. Oh, I've forgotten a very interesting period of my service. When I'd come up from Calapan, or Mindoro rather, Mindoro to Manila, I found I was ordered to post the coming reservation of Corregidor. They wanted to make it a military reservation. They first legally had to notify each citizen. Well, there were very few. Practically none of them could write. And all the little shacks were at the base of the heights. The post later on was built on the heights. That was just a jungle at that time. And I went over there and stayed with it. Two doctors who had a reserve hospital, as they called it, is sort of a convalescent hospital at the foot of the bluff and the little settlement of San Juan. I think it is called that. But I had to go. I went all over the island, went up on top, saw the guns that had been there when Dewey came in the harbor. And then I had to go to each island in turn and post one of my printed declarations of the government that it was taking over the whole place as a post. Now the first big island was close to the main island of Corregidor. That was not difficult at all. But there was one out at sea about, as I dimly recall, about 6 miles. And I went out there in a sailing banker. That is, it had a bamboo log on one side to offset the pull of the sail on the other. And that was quite a trip. And if the weather turned on you, it was pretty bad. There was nothing out on this island. It was bare rock. And I think that was El Mona, the nun. And then I had to go to another island, which was El Fraile. There, the gun was where the gun fired at Admiral Dewey as he came in. It is very hard to even get on the island, to scale it, because they're little blown-out gun platform was well above the water, but I got my card put up there. And then El Carabao was right next to the Cavite shore. That was about 12 miles across, as I dimly recall, from Corregidor. I went over there in my canoe and got caught in a pretty bad blow. But finally I got back to the main island of Corregidor safely. And then I returned and made my report in Manila. They didn't pay very much attention to me. There was nothing much lower than a second lieutenant, and I was about the junior second lieutenant in the Army at that time. I remember when I came up from the provinces, I had to turn in some money, and I had it in a sock. And the chief quartermaster was in a rage because the Filipino boy had thrown out his wastebasket in which he put his unfinished business, and not realizing it was papers that were still in use. So he was just infuriated with this situation, and I blew into my sock of money. He pretty much took me apart. However, I found he was pretty agreeable in the end, and sort of laughing at himself. And he afterwards became Quartermaster General of the Army. Humphrey was his name. I always had an interest in him because of the way he blew up and then the way he was nice to me later on. This money was to be turned in for my last post, Mangaran. Now I'm going to make a jump back to Mangaran because I went on several expeditions up in the mountains and managed to surprise a couple of Igorot camps, or mountain men, I guess we called them. But they were very effeminate, very small, and really quite effeminate, the men. The women even more so, and rather attractive. And they wore beads around their ankles and beads around their elbow, around their wrists and on their arms and around their neck, and anywhere you could fasten a bead. And they were very much frightened. You had to be pretty careful to surprise them first, because they would turn loose with poisoned arrows and other things like that, because they'd never seen a white man, and they were rather fearful of the Filipinos of that section, the Tagalogs, because I believe they had been pretty hard on them at times. And of course, they had firearms, and the Magallanes is the right name for them, mountain people, Magallanes. I remember I did one thing there. I went on an expedition trying to get at this so-called white tribe, and I left the boat with the two men on it, anchored well offshore so as they couldn't be surprised. At a small town well down to the south. When we got through with our turn back into the hills and surprising a couple of camps of Magallanes and trying to convince them that we meant them no harm. I remember finding five women without any stitch of clothing, not even a breech clout on any of them, in a little shelter that was made about 3 feet off the ground. And each one had a baby. And they were just frightened into frozen silence when I came up. And I tried to give each one of them a present. I gave one of them a cigar, and I gave one of them the band off the cigar, and I don't remember what I dug up to give to the other three, but they were all after the band. That was the most attractive thing of all, and that made me friendly, a friend of all of them. Later I saw a number of them close to the ocean. We were trying to get down to our ship, our sailboat, and we had too many for the boat, and we knocked a hole in the bottom on a submerged coral reef, and we had quite a trying time getting back to our base, which was a camp of these Magyanis on the seashore. We found they were trading with a Chinaman who had a large boat there, and that, of course, was against orders because all the ports on Mindoro were closed. However, I didn't see fit to say anything about this because they were just trading with the these Magyanis, and they were not at war with anybody, and it had no bearing on the conduct of the Philippine insurrection. So we had to wait until the tide came in order to float our boat, which was aground. And finally I went to sleep. I'd had a pretty tricky time with the men because they were had no opportunities to see women practically at all. And here were these little Magyani women, very attractive looking, certainly very attractive in comparison to the one or two Tagalog women down here where our station was. But I knew that would stir up great strife, and I had to stay awake to watch that. Finally, I got the sergeant and told him to sit by me and stay awake when I slept. And when I woke up, he'd been asleep too. Fortunately, nothing had occurred about the women. And finally, I thought it was time to get the boat off. The tide had begun to come in, but it hadn't come in enough to clear the boat. But I got down in the water with three or four others, and we tried to push the boat clear. The Chinaman was near me. He was pretty muscular. And in the water, at 3 a.m, on this night, I asked him, he spoke, finally betrayed the fact he could speak English. And I asked him where in the world he learned English. Here he was with this boat on this godforsaken shore there, trying to trade with these people and running the risk of getting in trouble with the military. Where did he learn his English? To my utter surprise, standing in the water almost up to his chin, he said, in Chicago. He had made his stake there and gone back to the Philippines and bought the China and bought this boat and was getting himself established. But I was very much surprised. It seemed an impossible sort of a situation. I'll tell a little more about that because we got the boat off, and to get on, we couldn't get below deck because it was loaded up to the guards, and it had a lot of nipa, I guess you'd call them shingles, for building. And you had to lie on top of these. Well, we started out at that night, and I woke up. I've never been so cold in my life. I thought I'd have inflammatory rheumatism the rest of my life. The men were all in a heap hugging each other, but I couldn't indulge in that heat propagating procedure. And I just lay there and speculated on how much of an affair I would have in the way of inflammatory rheumatism. We came in by close to a great cliff, sheer, and these members of the crew, stark naked, all with a breech clout, would run along the side with long staffs and pole the boat clear of the sheer wall, and we went around this point in that way. It was a weird-looking thing to see at night. Finally, we got back and found our own boat. I might say this was the Chinaman's boat all the time that I'd seized. And I bade him farewell. I didn't know as much about Chicago as he did. You asked me in 6 about Padre Isidro Sanz. He lived with me. That is, he took his meals with me. I furnished the coffee and sugar and flour, things of that sort, and he furnished the vegetables, the frijole beans and other things of that kind, which he could get his hands on, and I could not very well. I was found him a very interesting character. Unfortunately, my Spanish was so limited at that time that it's very difficult for him to, for me to communicate with him or he with me. But his conversation was very, very interesting. He'd been out there, as I recall, at that time, 18 years. Also with us for a while was Padre Feliz, and he'd been out there 25 years. One had come from Granada and one from Sevilla. And Padre Sanz was not quite the quality of priest that the other man was. Padre Sanz, I think, was more of a business priest, and he was down there looking after their holdings on what had been a very large horse ranch. They had had as many as 10,000 horses there. What the insurrectos had gotten in there and taken a great many of them away. Eduardo Llewellyn-Hardy was quite an interesting character. He was back up the river there quite a ways. It was quite a trip to get to him. And he was the most natural boss I've ever seen. He dominated everything around him. And I went to the wedding of a daughter. And this thing lasted two or three days. And was what we would say is muy borracho. But it was intensely interesting. And I had to keep the peace, or rather the goodwill of Eduardo, because he was a very important influence in the country. I don't remember that the padre playing the mandolin. My predecessor, Stone, Edward R. Stone, spoke Spanish very fluently, and he and the father got along much better than I did because their means of communication were so much more fluid. You refer in 7 to a Christmas Day affair. Actually, I don't know where Fry got a hold of that. Actually, we'd forgotten it was Christmas Day, and it wasn't until about midday that we discovered we were dealing with Christmas Day. The only thing we could get was a pig we had raised, which was still young and tender. So we killed the pig and roasted it and all sat down together to our Christmas dinner. I've forgotten any details of it, but it was the best we could do on the occasion. You refer in 8A to my inspection of the newly built McKinley. McKinley wasn't built at the time I went out there. As I recall, we went over the ground for the site of McKinley, and I had the battle which had been fought right there explained to me, and we found the line of cartridges that hadn't been picked up, the brass shells, which showed the line of the troops. I did not meet, no. I had dengue fever on the way up to the island in the Laguna de Bay, but it only lasted about 2 weeks. Captain Eames had come and taken over the company when we were still down in Calapan. As we went up to this island, he got a transfer to the 10th Infantry, so he and Mrs. Eames left. I remember the plague of grasshoppers, which you referred to in C. I think we had several. But I know it was so dense that riding horseback, I could hardly see, turn back and hardly see the tail of the horse in this flight of grasshoppers, which destroy the natives' crops almost completely. I don't remember about the burning of the Nipa dwellings in Manila. I remember very distinctly coming back to the United States on the Sherman in 1903. I think we came back, went through Nagasaki about early December. My recollection is we rode in a typhoon practically for 4 or 5 days, and I think one day we didn't even make a knot forward. It was very severe, and the whole sick bay was washed off the boat. There were three of us in a very stuffy little cabin, and it was very hard going. You couldn't get on deck at all, and you couldn't put a fifth of the people in the lounge, but that's the way things went in those days. My mind comes up to something that occurred not long before that, which had a rather amusing occurrence. A doctor gave us all a dinner at the Extramania. No, that was the delicatessen store, some hotel there that is right near the upper bridge across the river. And we had a private dining room upstairs, and there were about 12 or 16 of us, congenial people, and there was a big bay window with red curtains at the side, almost like a stage, and we were arranging a little operetta, as we called it. We had several musical members, and one or two very attractive members, and we were arranged the footlights out of all the various condiment bottles on the table in front of this bay window. And right in the middle of the thing, the police came in. Now, these were Americans, finest police force I ever laid my eyes on. They were selected from the volunteers that had been left in the Philippines, and that was the police force from Manila. They came in there because somebody had been dropping chairs out of the window two stories down on the people in the street. And we knew nothing about that till we found one of our members who hadn't participated in the play was very solemnly going around there. He was pretty tight and dropping these chairs out the window. Well, we were in Dutch with the cops then. However, our most attractive member persuaded the cop to take part in the play, so he remained up there and became one of the cast in this operetta we were doing. During those days, I didn't drink at all, so I could register pretty much what was happening. But I remember the gentleman was dropping the chairs out. Afterwards, he was an inspector, sort of an inspector general, as we called him, and he was investigating the case of a student officer at Venning. I was running the school then. Two student officers, and they had done something so semi-outrageous. And he came to me with his report and was seeking my advice as to what he should recommend be done to them. Well, I was sort of modifying his recommendation, though I wanted the place straightened up all right. And he turned to me, he said, "How can you pass by like in that manner, anything like this?" Well, I said, at least so-and-so, they didn't drop any chairs out the window on the people in the street. And he remembered for the first time some of his earlier performances in Manila. So the boys got off light. I remember on the Sherman stopping in Honolulu, and it was quite a different place from what I saw in later years. It was still a very quaint place, And we were there about a day and a half. And I'll go to the finish of it first. When the time came to sail, I had to go to the jail. And I found sitting out in the courtyard of the jail, almost half my company. They'd all been locked up for what they'd done. So I bailed them all out, and they went back to the boat. Better boys. Something else occurred there that made some impression on me, but I've forgotten entirely what it was. As to the Philippine insurrection under 9, I didn't know much about it. I only got in a little of it down south, and that was mainly with the ladrones, as they call them, up in the mountains. And I didn't see the great land battles or that part. So when I got back to the States, I was very much ashamed of myself that I knew so little about what had happened. And as I will explain later, I'd gotten a hold of all the records of the campaign in the Philippines, because they advise every officer that there are a lot of additional copies of that, and if the officer wanted, just put yes on the postcard, and I put yes on the postcard, and as I recall, I got 6 mail sacks full of these books, but they proved invaluable to me. They were illustrated, they were all the telegrams and letters and reports and happenings of the campaigns in the Philippines and the adjustments with Aguinaldo and matters of that sort. And I went through them all in great detail. And I remember seeing a request from Funston when he landed in Veracruz that if anybody had any copies of these things, to please send them down there, because there was the whole scheme of the buildup of civil government by an occupying military force from the time it had started with the occupation of Manila when the Spanish surrendered down to the final formal organization on a peaceful basis. I learned a great deal from this. I learned a great deal from it. I would, for instance, there were little fights going on all over the place. So many lieutenants were commanding towns, and the towns were being attacked, and the lieutenants were being sent out on expeditions. Well, it was very interesting to read the reports. One officer would make a great deal out of the thing. I remember distinctly one officer was reporting that he'd had 3 men wounded in this encounter, and he'd burnt the town down. And the general, Hughes, I think it was, returned this thing and said that if the fight was so severe that was no more severe than 3 men got wounded, it hardly justified burning the whole town down. It showed how they are apt to get out of hand when they are on their own and critical situations. I know that right near Manila, there's a cathedral there that had what was considered the finest library east of the Suez, and it was burnt down. I got at the facts from the records, and I found that some of the Americans had taken the robes of the priests and the silver services from the chancel, and were executing a dance outside. So however quiet you may be in your home district, when you get abroad on a wartime basis, under conditions extremely difficult of heat and everything of that sort, you're apt to do things that you would utterly discountenance at another time. And of course the discipline was very loose, because these troops were very hastily organized, and they were serving under most difficult and trying conditions. And on the other side, they were having very horrible reactions to our prisoners by the our opponents in some cases. Generally speaking, the feeling of the men, the officers, at this time, particularly in connection with the trial of officers for participating in what is called the water cure. I found the feelings of the officers in law were very bitter against the civil authorities who were trying to build up under Taft the civil government. I think the army was, I think maybe the civil officials went too far too fast. However, though, I think that the feelings of the army were naturally very bitter, and I do not think they were justified. I think that's the reaction you will always have, but it's pretty hard to keep the military, who suffered so much from these things, accepting all the overtures of peace, we might call it, though it wasn't a general peace, and the civil commission, who hasn't been involved in that, rather impatient with the troops as to their reactions. Both sides are wrong. Both reactions are perfectly natural. It needs a very tempered control to be exerted. And I would say one of the best things to be would have been to discharge the fine officers that they had, knowing they were fine, and have made them into these civil officials who were trying to establish civil government, because they'd have a much better understanding of the point of view, which is pretty hard for a man who just comes out from the States, never gone through any of it, and now he comes into these fellows who suffered the tortures of the damned, as it were, in so many ways, have had such violence in the treatment by the enemy and all, which has provoked them to do things they shouldn't have done. It makes altogether a regrettable situation. However, when the smoke all cleared away, the army and the natives' leaders were very friendly, and it wasn't until civil control got fully in place and the political reactions began stirred up that the general bitterness developed. I did not meet Aguinaldo. I saw him once, but I didn't meet him. I learned many things from my first command. It's hard to tell me which one it was. I remember one affair. We'd worked out from Mangaren, sailed around and landed some distance out, and it was a little barrio or tiny village. And we were going through that in order to get on firm land, away from the swamps, to get back up in the mountains. And we found these people working on a pony. It developed that a crocodile had almost bitten off the hip of the pony, a haunch, I guess you'd call it. And they were just sewing him up without any regard to the pony's feelings. And that horrified the men. And right close by was this stream, rather narrow, but deep, and heavy brush on either side. And we went into this stream in single file. I had seven men. They were behind me, and they were holding their rifles up and their ammunition belts up to keep them clear from the water. When we got about two-thirds of the way across, there was a splash up above us, and one fellow yelled, "Crocodile!" Well, in about a second, they all plunged ahead. They ran over me. I was ground right down to the bottom, and their feet went up my back and over me and up the other side. I finally came to the surface pretty well done up, and I was confronted then by a situation. These men had really panicked. The sight of the pony with his hip almost bitten off by a crocodile, the splash, and then this yell, "Crocodile!" and this stream, had just upset them completely. And they'd, not intentionally, but had completely gone over me, and I was ground right down in the bottom. I did some very fast thinking, fortunately, and I got to the surface, and then I went up the steep bank where the seven men were standing there looking very guilty, very uncertain of themselves. All the time I was thinking, and so when I got up to the top, I took my position in front of them, covered wet and covered in mud, and fell them in very formally, and then gave them right shoulder arms, face them to the right, and march them down into the stream and clear to the other side. And as they reached the other bank, I gave them to the rear march, and they came back up out of the crocodile stream. Then I halted them, faced them towards me, inspected their guns, and then gave them fallout. And then we started on our excursion up into the mountains there, trying to find this insurrecto holdout. They never referred to it. I never referred to it. I thought afterwards that I had done what I think was just about the right thing. It wasn't a time for cussing around. I have no comment to make on the early occupation of the Philippines. My Lord, I was just a second lieutenant with an extremely, extremely limited observation. I got most of mine by reading, which all occurred after that particular time. Matter of fact, it occurred after I got back home, because I didn't get these books till then. Then I went back to the Philippines 10 years later and went over battlefields and went into the entire history of the affair from the time of the occupation of Manila down to the final capture of Aguinaldo. E. Army life at this time was diversified, just put it mildly. There were all sorts and conditions of fellows. The army had to be virtually remade. The officers had been very hurriedly made. They'd been made by the ranks largely. They were disciplined and undisciplined. They were on their own, irresponsible. Some of them doing magnificent work and receiving no appreciation for it. Altogether, it was quite a trying period. Do you want to be recorded here?
No.
Is it going? It takes a while to boil down and refine such a force. It invariably occurs. Nobody thinks it's possible at the start. What they were all looking at, the old armies that were, was the type of officer and type of discipline, non-commissioned officer, that existed in 1897, that had gone through the Indian campaigns and out in the West. It was a long time before this new army, with all of the new blood that had been taken into it, all of the volunteers that had been given commissions, and the exciting things that had happened were absorbed and boiled down. For example, here I was, straight from civil life, no school of any kind, no preparation of any kind, and I was virtually the governor of the southern end of the island of Mindoro at that time. I didn't even have enough blank forms to make out the returns, because those that were in existence there had all been in a barrel and they were ruined by a typhoon. And I had to make up some blank forms that I'd never seen before, and they were a curiosity what I finally whittled out. But as I say, here I was from civil life. The only traditions I had were from the VMI. And of course, they were very helpful there because I had some basis to go on. But the other takes quite a while refining. I'll give you a few little examples to show how curious the setup was. When we got up to Santa Mesa, 5 miles outside of the, 8 miles outside of the city of Manila, to say I was not doing any drinking, and I had my ankle very badly sprained or fractured by horse rolling on it, which confined me to my quarters in this place where there were about 12 or more officers. Sometimes it went up to 20, I know. We had our mess there. All lived there. And some very, very hard drinking. Now, they couldn't go home. This was during the demobilization of the army. They couldn't go home till their papers were cleared. The inspector would come out. He was later my colonel at Fort Reno, Oklahoma. He would come out to try to straighten this up. Well, it was pretty hopeless. Some of these fellows had great influence in civil life, and to put it politely, they didn't give a damned. They made little effort to get their papers cleared, and they couldn't have cleared them by themselves to save their necks, because they had so smeared the thing up that it was very, very hard to get the straight of the affair, and each one was always accountable for property. Well, I had one officer. This came later. He'd gotten a commission. And in the regular service, he'd been a captain of volunteers. And when he struck Seattle, he just left the ship. He was responsible for the ship. He was quartermaster of the ship. He just left the ship, went off and caught up with his regiment, and went in its parades at Seattle and its entrainment for back home. Then he accepted a first lieutenancy in the Army. He got back out to the Philippines, and he came to me in great distress. He had a letter from the quartermaster general. In going through the records, they found that he had left all the things on the ship, like the chairs and silverware, the cooking utensils, everything on the ship was listed. And he'd gone off and left it all. And, of course, they just sopped it up. I don't mean they sold it, but they just got ahead that much so they'd never be caught short themselves. He was responsible for it all, and he couldn't get his finger on a piece of it. And, of course, he was just chained to the Philippines until he cleared himself. Well, we had things like that all the time. We had one fellow that was the son of a very important man in the railroad world, and he had just done ducks and drakes with everything, and he was intoxicated a good bit of the time. And his papers were almost impossible to put together. Well, in any event, this colonel of the Inspector General's Department would come out to see if these men could clear themselves so they could go home. Well, finally, he quit sending for them. He just sent for me. I was right in the building, and I was lame and on crutches. And he and I would work out what this thing was and find out whether the man could go home or not. I became quite an expert on papers at that time. I knew more about him, I guess, than anybody else around there but the inspector. And it helped me a great deal later years and that sort of thing. But it was a most disorganizing affair. And it seemed rather odd. I was the junior officer. The inspector would come out from Manila, this very dignified colonel, and he'd send for me, and I'd come in on my crutches. And he'd say, bring me the papers of these fellows, and we'd bring them to the dining table and sit down there, and he and I would work on these things pretty much all day. And maybe he could clear some, maybe he couldn't. I've been explaining a good bit what Army life was like at this time. I don't think there's anything more to add. If I've said a good bit about the soldiers at this time, they were, there was some of the old soldiers there, but most of them were fellows that had been enlisted very hurriedly, and not at all like a citizen army. As I said, my company was largely enlisted across the tracks there in Columbus, Ohio. Across the tracks, meaning in the toughest element of the space of the town. I don't know anything I can add there. I went about and did my business. Had some very good friends. I had a sense of humor which helped me very frequently. Fort Reno. We arrived there a few days after Christmas in 1903. We had our Christmas Eve party in the Harvey restaurant at Omaha, Nebraska, and the waitresses stayed away from a party of theirs to wait on us and all danced with us later. And the Christmas Day party we had in, as I think it was Christmas Day, in, well, it was in, I'll have to skip it, I can't remember it. I know we all were guests of the runner of the Harvey, manager of the Harvey Eating House, and we got him to include all the waitresses at the table, so they sat at the table with us, and we had a very gay party and a very good meal. Fort Reno was quite another thing. It is an old frontier post. I used to like to look in the little cadets, little cemetery, and find that this grave was a man that had been killed at the Battle of Turkey Creek, and so on. And there were all the wives. Here lays the wife of so-and-so, who was a very famous scout, very stunning-looking man. He had four wives there. The surroundings were attractive. The reservation about 16 miles square and was next to the Cheyenne and Arapaho reservations, right across the river from us. And the hunting was superb. And we went shooting almost every day of the year for something or other. We started up our first garrison schools down there. And my formal military education began at that time. But the schools didn't amount to very much. I was sent down to Texas to the headquarters of the 1st Cavalry at Fort Clark, Texas, to map about 2,000 square miles, I think that was it, along the Rio Grande and the Devil's River, out from Del Rio towards Sanderson, Texas. This was the hardest service I ever had in the Army. The thermometer would go up to 130, and I had to walk the track and count the rails. That gave me an exact measurement, which I needed as a sort of a baseline. I got my distances otherwise from the odometer on the wheel of the wagon and from the time scale on the walking of my horse. It was a very trying life. I remember I would have the effect of too much acidity from the bacon and no fresh vegetables of any kind. Heartburn so badly that I could barely drink without gasping. As I recall, I went in there weighing about 165 or 70, and I came out weighing 132 pounds. Great many things happened there, but I don't think they add to this tale. This required, in a sense, more leadership on my part than almost anything else, because it was all hard going and at times rather dangerous going. I remember one period, one stretch there, the old packer and myself were without water for 18 hours and had to travel for near 50 miles. Now, this was an endurance contest of the first class. Here I saw for the first time the officer who I succeeded as chief of staff, Malin Craig. He was the captain of a company, and I was using two of his horses on this trip. I had a heterogeneous costume on of an old Panama hat which a mule had bitten the top out of, and I tried to sew it together, and I was burnt almost black. And when the sergeant took in the horses, Captain Craig met him, and the sergeant wanted him to talk to me, and Craig wouldn't look at me. He didn't think I could be an officer. And he talked entirely to my old sergeant, who was a very fine character with a long cavalry mustache drooping at the sides. And he was about to be, I think he was in his 27th year of service. This, as I've said, was a very difficult period. and tried me out more in handling men than as to my judgment than almost anything else. I did have Company G at Fort Reno, and I was at the same time post quartermaster and commissary officer. This was a very trying period because the commanding officer was exceedingly difficult, and he made me his adjutant. And altogether, that was rather hard going. It turned out all right, but it required very careful handling on my part, which was part of the Army experience. Of course, we went shooting all the time. There was shooting every day of the year there, one kind and another. That time I was a pretty good shot. And we would go out and camp for 10 days on Indian reservation right next to the river. We'd get channel cat, which are very good eating, in the river. I've shot ducks that would fall on the tents. And I remember on one occasion, Mrs. Marshall and I were early for breakfast, and we heard the quail calling in a little sumac grove near us. And I went out there and in about 30 minutes came back for breakfast and I had 12 quail. Actually, I think I had 15, but I don't want to claim that. I couldn't, as to A, I couldn't say what things impressed me most. The main thing was I had a very difficult job and there wasn't very much understanding of it by the junior officer, not in age but in rank, at headquarters who handled that sort of thing, and it made it very difficult for the young officer out in the field. But it was part of the game, and it was a great lesson to me, and a very valuable one. Living conditions in the post at that time are very pleasant. If you could get a servant, I finally got a hold of a fine girl from Canada. She was the daughter of a deceased enlisted man, and her mother dwelt on what we call Soapsuds Row at that time in the post. We paid her way back from Canada, and she stayed with us for years, and was with us quite a while at Fort Leavenworth, and we were very fond of her. Later on, I saw her after the First World War, and she was the wife of a major who had started off as a non-commissioned officer. I think he was a temporary major. You asked me what are some of the things that I learned at that time. There were so many things in all these things. There's a continual picking up of things. And I was rather given to analysis of why and wherefore and so on, which unconsciously, in the end, was rather helpful. D, yes, I met some people during this period that I was to work with afterwards in the First War. But at Fort Reno, almost none. An Army wife in those days had to face a great deal. If she could get a hold of a servant, she was in luck. But the pay was very slender, and I had an account book that I kept at that time because it's the only time I ever kept an account like that, but my pay was so limited I had to watch every cent. And some of the things I think would be rather interesting. I can remember very well two or three that always amused my wife in later years. Spring hat was $3.50, and the spring suit was $14. I can remember that quite well. But I had to keep track of it down to the last dime. My struggle was to come out ahead. I really wasn't so much interested in whether it was $1.50 or $10.50 ahead of for the month, but it was to be ahead and not getting behind. I always struggled in those days to have a month's pay ahead, and I lived on that month rather than on the pay I was getting for the immediate month I was living in. I also would try to have a sum on hand that would be the equivalent of the cost of moving. In those days, you see, the government didn't move our wives or families, and we got a very limited allowance for our packing our things up, and we had to pack them ourselves and get things ourselves and get a hold of the lumber ourselves, or you were stuck. What the Army gets now seems very wonderful, would have seemed very wonderful in those days, but we got literally nothing. You see, we had no representation by vote. A citizen army can vote, and it can get the attention of the press and the attention of Congress in a moment. An army such as I served in then, the press wasn't interested in them. The Congress wasn't interested in them, except to keep down the appropriation as closely as they could. It was not as we would call a citizen army. That has great political power, and we've seen the manifestations of it in one way or another. My finish at Fort Reno occurred at the time the command moved to Fort Leavenworth for maneuvers. I was left in charge of the post. I was the only officer. I think there must have been we had no doctor. We had a contract surgeon, a man that came from town to serve the garrison on a contract basis. It was, some things were amusing and others very difficult. The women would all flock to me for this, that, and the other thing. I remember I'd go down the front line and a woman would come out and want me to do some for her house, and I found a lot of white lead, so I would always offer to paint her bathroom white, but that's the best I could do, and she'd generally accept that, and I'd make a promise not to tell the other women, and then I'd paint the next lady's bathroom white. But the most enjoyable part of the thing was I went along what's called Soap Suds Row in the old days, and the houses were just little shacks, and they were in dreadful condition, and the yards were just bare sand or clay, and most unattractive, most unappealing. And I went by one woman's house, and she came out to me, and she was a sergeant's wife, and he was away at Fort Leavenworth. Fort Riley, I should have said all the time. That's where the maneuvers were. And